This is What Does It Profit? And I'm your host, Dr. Dawn Carpenter. In this show, we talk about value, the social and moral value of business. Each episode, each guest will bring me a little closer to finding out what does it profit. Now, those of you who are new to the show, on What Does It Profit, we're all about creating community. So welcome to the WDIP, or WDIP community, one and yet another long line of acronyms you'll hear on the show. As you know, I'm a former investment banker turned business ethicist with the heart of a teacher. In my approach to ethics, all our conversations relate to the human value of contribution. Our human dignity demands that not only do we contribute to our own development, but we also have a call on our lives to help others contribute. And just think about all those contributive injustices that occur when we are marginalized, discriminated against, and just plain not included. Last week, we talked to Logan Scott, the manager for diversity and inclusion at the Walt Disney Corporation. We talked to Logan about superheroes, inclusion, diversity, and what all that means for business. This week, we're going to switch things up a bit. We're going to talk about the idea of inclusion, but from a slightly different perspective. We're going to learn all about the economic structure called a co-op. Sure, you've likely heard of housing co-ops, maybe even worker or agricultural co-ops, but do you know just how ubiquitous they are? Let's talk everything co-ops with Casey Fannin, president of the National Cooperative Bank. And now let's welcome to What Does It Profit, Casey Fannin. Casey, how are you?
I'm doing well, Dawn. Nice to hear you.
Nice to hear you too. I am so excited to be talking with you because I always love talking to people who love doing what they do. And in my mind, I get the sense that you are really into co-ops.
Yeah, sure thing. I've been at NCB for 25 years and we live and breathe co-ops.
Well, of course you do. I wanted to jump in a lot of different places, but I think let's start with what is a co-op? So imagine, you know, you're talking to our listeners now. Imagine that they really don't have much exposure to co-ops at all. Maybe they're aware of like a grocery store or maybe a housing co-op. Let's start at the very beginning. Generally speaking, what is a co-op?
A co-op is a type of an organizational structure and design in which the people or companies who use and benefit from the products or services that the co-ops generate also own the co-op itself. And so member owners is a common term you hear in the co-op space. There are seven co-op principles, but I think that the three that really drive home, I think the core of what co-ops are about are democratic member control, member economic participation, and concern for community. I think those three, in my mind, sort of put a fine point on you know, what co-ops are really all about.
Let's go a little bit deeper now. There are, you know, different types of co-ops. You know, I was just mentioning as I was kind of setting up that question. Walk our listeners through kind of the genre of co-ops.
Yeah, I think so many of us are touched by co-ops and we may not even know it. Sometimes we say they're a well-kept secret. I would say there are really four types of co-ops generally accepted. The first is a purchasing co-op. So a purchasing co-op really harnesses the economies of scale and purchasing power for its members. And some examples of a purchasing co-op are Ace Hardware, ShopRite grocery stores, who are all, each store is a member of the Wakefern Cooperative, and Carpet One. Those are some examples of purchasing co-op that drive lower prices to their members. There's a category of producer co-ops, and these are typically members who have a common industry that are looking to move up the value chain. So I think of agricultural co-ops. It's an agricultural heavy category. Think Ocean Spray, Cabot Creamery, Sunkist, Land of Lakes.
Wow, you found my refrigerator.
Yes, yes. No, our refrigerator is loaded with co-op products for sure.
Yeah, another I'm going to interrupt you because maybe this is a segue to what I think is really cool. All our listeners know that I love music. So it's like the top 40. You go even farther. It's the top 100 of co-ops. You actually keep track of these really big ones. Just tell our listeners just a little bit about that as a quick detour, and we'll get back to this list of different types of co-ops.
Sure. For many years, NCB has created the Co-op 100, which is a list of America's top 100 cooperatives. And they range in category and in industry. A lot of credit unions are on that list. A lot of agricultural co-ops are on that list. Purchasing co-ops, like I said earlier, co-ops touch so much of the American consumer and the American business. And oftentimes they're in the background. You don't see them, but they're a critical area of the U.S. economy.
Yeah. So our listeners can go out and Google Co-op 100 and find the list. I venture to say that a lot of those names sound pretty familiar. So let's go back to these purchasing co-ops. So that was where we were on your list.
Sure. Another category of co-ops are worker co-ops. And a worker co-op can really be in any industry. And the key element of a worker co-op is the worker owners own the company and manage the company. It's managed by the employees. There's a lot of energy in the space today and the home care co-op world, where home care is becoming more and more prominent, certainly in the COVID days. And those co-ops for home care make a meaningful impact to the employees providing that care. And then, you know, the last category is consumer co-ops. And, you know, consumer co-ops provide a common good or service for its members. Many of us are members. REI is a consumer cooperative. I think who doesn't like getting up to the counter at REI and getting the option to reduce the cost of your next purchase with the patronage dividend of prior activity with REI. So much of the country gets their electricity from electric co-ops, purchase food from food co-ops, live in housing co-ops, all examples of consumer co-ops. My personal favorite is a babysitting co-op that my wife and I joined when we were the parents of two young children in Washington, D.C., 400 miles from the closest family member. By joining that babysitting co-op in our community, you know, it provided a great service, tied us into the community, and certainly was a great experience for us and our children. So much so that a couple of years later, the kids went to a cooperative nursery school. It was such a good experience for us.
Then on to cooperative colleges and conquering the universe. That's maybe the next foray. But let's dial it back and talk about the bank a little bit. The bank itself is a co-op.
It is. It is. We have a unique history. We were formed in 1978 during the Carter administration. NCB was created by an act of Congress, which is pretty unique for, you know, a bank. Carter, as a, you know, Georgian peanut farmer, I think understood co-ops across the country, but he also understood that it was largely a misunderstood category, particularly for capital providers. So I think NCB was really put on this planet as a government-sponsored entity, much like a Fannie or Freddie, albeit much smaller, to serve and provide financial products and services to America's cooperatives. You know, interestingly, a couple years later, during the Reagan administration, in an effort to really shrink the size of the federal government, Reagan tried to close the bank down. And so the NCB leadership at the time said, the heck with that, and said, well, we'll convert to a co-op. And so it was really in 1981 where we became a co-op ourselves. And today we've grown considerably. We have over 3,000, almost 3,500 co-op members that we distribute our patronage checks to every year at NCB. And we're doing business in all 50 states as a co-op. Still have some ties to the U.S. government in some unique ways, but a co-op ourselves.
I want to talk about that for a minute. You're talking about this patronage dividend. And I don't want to get too nerdy with our listeners, but I get excited about this because really what, in a sense, can happen is if your borrowers, and stop me if I'm not quite getting this right, but you know, your borrowers can choose to become members. And if they do, then they share in the benefits of the bank itself. And so that actually is money back. Just like the REI example you gave, put that in the lending space. It's pretty cool.
That's exactly right. Yeah, we can get real nerdy on patronage dividends, but it's staying at a high level. The earnings and the profit that NCB generates is distributed back to those who helped us create that profit in the first place. And so the patronage dividend corresponds to the amount of business and income that you helped generate for the bank. Very equitable. And a great distribution of that profit to those who generated it.
Well, I suspect this comes in a lot of different flavors at NCB. So there are different industry sectors that the bank works in. So not you mentioned, for example, credit unions. People might not realize that a credit union, you know, it's a co-op.
Absolutely.
Before we go on, I mean, just tell people a little bit about how that works.
Sure. There are thousands of credit unions across the country, and credit unions like NCB are financial cooperatives. And, you know, when you become a member of a credit union, you, similar to NCB, have a role in governance and have a role in the profits, or in most cases, the savings generated by these credit unions that are passed on to the members. You know, I think that credit unions in particular are very connected with their community, often have an eye towards helping those who are in great need and creating unique programs, whether it be educational or financial products and services that help their community. So a great example of a cooperative.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you walked us through that, because people may have had experiences with their credit union and not really realize that they've really had a meaningful interaction with a real co-op. So I'm glad you gave us that example. I'm thinking about some of the other areas also that the bank is involved in. I'll just pull an area that kind of comes immediately to mind, because it's important to all of us, particularly given the current economic and social environment and so forth, is housing. It's so fundamental to life on Earth. Tell us what the energy is like in the co-op housing space.
The housing co-ops, their history is really urban focused and high cost markets. So think New York City, Chicago, Washington, D.C., where the cost of land was high. And cooperators get together to form a housing co-op to have that ownership of their unit, but affordably. And they reap the benefits of value rather than a landlord. I think, you know, since the early days of housing co-ops have spread to all 50 states. They're no longer just urban, and they touch all aspects of housing, senior and affordable, in particular those two. I think are really where the energy is today in housing co-op, is particularly in the development side. Senior housing co-ops across the country provide this community for the senior members, both in the design of the physical space and certainly the design of governance. You walk into a senior housing co-op and there's typically a list of committees that the senior housing members can be part of. They have shared space, you know, wood shops, they have, you know, underground parking, wide hallways. It's designed specifically for their members. Cultural committees, it's quite exciting to walk in and to visit your customer and be welcome to a slice of birthday cake that they're celebrating in the community room. It's a nice feel. The other area—
Can I stop you there for just a second? I just want to draw the distinction between the alternative. How do you put that up against other senior living type of arrangements? And we're talking about how wonderful this is, but let's help our listeners understand in comparison to what. So I think of a nursing home where, you know, maybe there's a sense of isolation.
I think that most of the senior housing co-ops are sort of fit more neatly into the independent living and sort of a little bit into the assisted living. But I think that, you know, you think of independent living communities, nice communities by all means, but they don't have that sense of community, that sense of ownership that a senior housing co-op does. That pride of ownership and the connection to the community through governance really moves people and connects people to where they live in a way that a non-cooperative community can't do.
Interesting. All right. I interrupted you and you were going to another area of activity and energy in the affordable housing co-op space. Maybe you can give us some examples of what that looks like.
You know, I think affordable housing co-ops, sometimes referred to as limited equity housing co-ops, are seeing a pretty strong growth, you know, right now across the country. And you think about it, the cost of housing is so high in so many communities, it really impacts people and their ability to comfortably live. So I think affordable housing co-ops create that opportunity to have ownership. You know, you're not a renter at that point. You are an owner, and you get to control through voting, you know, how your community is run, you know, where that dollar is spent. And it's really meaningful. One of the biggest areas we see growth in right now for housing co-ops is resident-owned communities. So manufactured housing communities who start off as renters and then convert to housing co-op owners.
Hey, Casey, let me ask you a question about that. Because
sure.
I think of manufactured housing, derogatory term, I guess, is mobile homes. I don't get the sense they were ever designed to be a permanent place. Because if I get this right, the land underneath the home itself is not owned by the homeowner.
That's right. I think that in a traditional form, that home is on land owned by a landlord. And so you pay rent to the landlord for putting your home on the land. And, you know, you mentioned the word mobile. That's a big misnomer in the space because these homes are very immobile. You can't just pick up and move in any easy way your home. And landlords have really figured that out. And I think oftentimes, not in all cases, but certainly there are many examples of landlords who have taken advantage of that fact and raise that ground rent significantly each year. So, you know, tenants get together and form tenant associations in many cases, either on their own or through groups like, you know, Rock USA that does this nationwide
help. Can I interrupt you? Tell our listeners who Rock USA is. Rock is ROC. It's an acronym.
Rock USA stands for Resident-Owned Communities, and Rock USA is a group out of New Hampshire who NCB's worked very closely with, along with MetLife, to help create some of these resident-owned communities in the cooperative form. So, you know, Rock USA and through some of their providers work with these tenants and purchase the land from the landowner. And so NCB, Rock, USA, MetLife, in many cases, will provide loans collectively at 110% loan to value to form this co-op. Members can buy in sometimes as low as $500. And then they become owners of their community. It's really a great thing. We've had great experience, great performance, great credit metrics. And we're very proud to be part of that. I think that there's been some studies that have shown that the average annual increase of the cost of ownership is only one third that of an otherwise a community that was otherwise rented. So, you know, that's the savings and that value creation that is created by the housing co-op. And, you know, and similar to the senior co-op example, as a tenant, you just live there. As an owner, you manage the property. You now have control of the fate of that community. One of my favorite examples is a couple of years ago, I was in Massachusetts visiting a new co-op community. And one of the women on the board of directors had said, you know, wasn't until they became a co-op where she really kind of came out of her introvert shell and got involved with committees on the co-op. And lo and behold, on that committee, she met her future husband. And so what a nice thing to see. You know, I can't guarantee romantic love for all cooperators, but
okay, it was a great example. That's a great dividend. What's the expression? Past performance isn't a guarantee of future returns or something like that. Good work on that one. Well, that actually takes us to a happy place, which maybe is a nice segue to our quintessential What Does It Profit podcast question. I'm going to ask you it this way. You know, we've been talking about co-ops, and my sense is, like, if I was to categorize all of this activity, it's an effort to create a more inclusive economy. So let me ask you, cooperatives, in the context of creating an inclusive economy, what does it profit?
Yeah, great question. You know, I think the key to the co-op structure is its membership and its economic participation. And as a result, the economic benefits are given back to the members of the cooperative. And those economic benefits can be lower costs of products and services, or the profits generated by the cooperative that are delivered back to those who helped create the profit. So I think with the benefits staying within the same ecosystem and the same community, I think the community wins and I think everybody wins. I think it's a great equitable sharing of that economic benefit.
Well, Casey, I'm glad that you shared today all of this. For some listeners, maybe very new information, and inspired others to think about the co-op model and about just generally finance as a force for good in society. So I'm glad that we had the opportunity to have this kind of conversation. So Casey, thank you very much for joining us on What Does It Profit?
Thank you, Dawn. I had a great time. Thank you.
Our pleasure. Come back. You've been listening to What Does It Profit? Thanks to those who have gotten the word out about the show. This week, I want to shout out to a photographer named Jeffrey Bruno, who's working with us to help bring my website, dawncarpenter.com, into prime time. This site should be totally revamped in the next few weeks. But to do this, I'm headed to New York City soon to join him for a photo shoot around my old stomping grounds on Wall Street. Stay tuned for that. And in the meantime, check out Jeff's amazingly captivating images on Instagram. In our next episode, we're going to stay in the co-op space for a while, This time, we're going to dive deep with one of America's most beloved agricultural co-ops, Cabot Creamery. Roberta McDonald will join us to tell her story and the Cabot story. Roberta is the Senior Vice President for Brand Strategy at the Cabot Creamery Cooperative, where she has labored in love for nearly 33 years. Her inspiring story is a testament to the transformative power of co-ops, both within our communities and within our very selves. Stay tuned for this conversation. It's going to be one that you won't want to miss. In the meantime, follow us on social media to keep up with the show and to help us build the What Does It Profit community. Again, we're hanging out mostly on LinkedIn and Twitter at the moment. And please don't forget to subscribe and tell your friends about the show. You can meet the team and sign up for our weekly newsletter on our website, whatdoesitprofitpodcast.com. What Does It Profit is written and hosted by me, Dr. Dawn Carpenter. The show is produced by Jordan Gaspore and edited by Switchinboard Studios. And the executive producer is me. Special thanks to our talented interns, Niels, Hannah, and Sean, other team members, and our long and illustrious group of friends and supporters can be found at whatdoesitprofitpodcast.com. Before I let you go, let me remind you to never stop asking yourself, what does it profit?